Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to our third session of our three-part series called Headlines, Halachic Debates of Current Events. And tonight, we look at a very hot topic, which is, well, we're starting off by framing it as a discussion about the Vatican, but really, it's so much more. It's so much more than the Vatican. It touches on so many areas of halacha, areas of Jewish law. We're going to talk about world religion, we're going to talk about Christianity, Islam, Judaism, churches, synagogues, mosques, wine, business transactions, Sundays versus Saturdays, and of course, visiting the Vatican as well. So, let's jump straight into the conversation. There are many secret artifacts housed in the Vatican. How do I know? In the office over here, there's a red phone. Do you know where that red phone goes? Straight kidding. There's no red phone. But one thing we know is that a lot of the treasures of the temple ended up in the hands of Rome. There's the famous Arch of Titus that depicts various items from the Beit HaMikdash, the Holy Temple in Jerusalem, when it was destroyed by the Romans nearly 2,000 years ago. Famous the Arch of Titus that depicts in this engraving, in this carving, treasures of the temple being hauled away to Rome. Where did they end up? Where are they? You think they're in Venice on the boats over there? They're not in Venice. They're in the Vatican, as far as we know. There have been reports of people discovering or reporting that they've discovered, or they heard that others have discovered various items and artifacts of the temple. So it behooves us in a course called Headlines to talk about this very interesting topic. Has anybody read the Da Vinci Code?
Yes.
Okay, it's not required reading for tonight. So, but it's a fascinating concept about these secrets, right? Secrets that exist in the church, secrets that exist in Italy, in Rome, etc. So tonight we look at some Jewish considerations of the Vatican, Rome. Oh, we'll also talk about, in the course of tonight's discussion, what is the status, what is the halachic status of a church? And is one permitted to visit a church for various reasons? Let's say for voting. Let's say there's a polling station, a voting station in a church. You let it go to a church. Vatican to tour and to see the artwork, which is the direct topic. What about a funeral, God forbid, a service? And what if a president, doesn't matter whichever president you like, imagine that president, your favorite president ever, called you up. He might be gone and deceased by now. Who cares? President calls you up and says, hey, come to the National Prayer Service following the inauguration, but it's taking place at a church in Washington, D.C. There you go. Can you see it? Can you go to a concert as well? All of these questions will be addressed in tonight's class. It's going to be a lot of fun. We begin by exploring the laws of idolatry. And you'll see why this is very important. It becomes very important very soon. Let us begin with page number 2. Ray, please read text 1A, text 1B, text 1C, but one by one, and let's go through it. Let me introduce 1A. This comes from the Ten Commandments. These are the opening few commandments. Ray, in your best God impersonation voice. I'm kidding. You don't have to do that. Just read it as you wish.
We can have
reverb. Yeah, post-production is great on this.
Took you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall not have the gods of others in my presence. You shall not make for yourself a graven image or any likeness which is in the heavens above, which is on the earth below, or which is in the water beneath the earth. You shall neither prostrate yourself before them nor worship them.
And of course the commandments continue with God's top 10, but these are the ones that speak about monotheism. God saying, I'm your God, Don't have any other gods. It's an exclusive relationship. When we talk about Abraham, the first Jew, what made him the first Jew? Well, he was one of the first people to discover and to believe in monotheism, and he was also the first one to take it upon himself as his life's mission to teach that and to spread that as well. So the idea of monotheism is a very Jewish concept, and strict monotheism means one God. No others, just one. Ray, please continue text 1b.
The name of the gods of others you shall not mention. It shall not be heard through your mouth.
So that's another element, another layer to this. This comes from another Torah portion. Three chapters later, after the Ten Commandments are recorded, it talks about not mentioning the names of the gods of others. Continue, please, 1c. This is now a few books later, the book of Deuteronomy.
The graven images of their gods you will burn with fire. You shall not covet the silver or gold that is upon them and take it for yourself, lest you be ensnared by it. For it is an abomination to the Lord your God. Nor should you bring an abomination into your house, lest you are to be destroyed like it. But you shall utterly detest it, and you shall utterly abhor it, for it is to be destroyed.
Okay, and those are some other prohibitions that are mentioned there in text 1c. So here we go. And I realize now the discussion question on the next page, number 1, really should have been after these three texts. I probably put it after text 2, because that adds another layer to it. But nonetheless, I want to ask this question now as well. What activities are included in the prohibition against idolatry? How many different areas of forbidden practice can you identify in text 1a, 1b, and 1c? In no particular order. Just call them out. What can't we do?
Make an image.
Good. What else?
You can't worship it.
Worship it. Next.
You can't prostrate yourself.
Don't bow down to it.
You can't have them in your presence.
Don't have them in your presence. No presence. Joking. Don't mention their name. Good.
Can't they covet the gold and silver? Ah,
I like that one. Okay, so no coveting. What that means is this is a message in Deuteronomy before the Jews enter the land that would become known as Israel. It was the land of Canaan. There lived pagan nations. They worshipped idols. And the point is, don't worship those things, but maybe you're going to want the gold and the silver. It's precious. It's valuable. What should we do with it? It says burn it with fire, but burn it with fire. We can melt it. We can sell it. You know, buy low, sell high. This is the Jewish way. That's how we roll. Right? Buy wholesale, sell retail. Easy as pie. Right? Let me grab some idle metal and sell it to, some trophy macher. Who knows? Whatever it is. Right? So what could go wrong? So the Torah says, no, look at this. It is an abomination to the Lord your God. If something was used, and I feel like I want to focus on this one. The other ones are fairly straightforward, I think. But if something was used in the context of idolatry, of idol worship, Jewish law says you are not allowed to use it in its form, nor can you derive any benefit from any of its forms. You understand what's going on here? A person would say, I'm not bowing down to the molten image. I'm literally like memeing. I don't know if this is called memeing. Miming. Meme is something else. It's an image. Miming. So many modern terminologies. I'm not going to bow down to this thing. I'll just use the gold. I'll use the silver. I'll make a nice necklace for my wife. Can't do it. It's asur bahana. You can't have any pleasure, derive any benefit, or any value from that item that was used in the context of idolatry. Yes?
Question about the third sentence.
Yes.
First, text 1a. So it says...
no graven image?
First it says, you shall not have gods of others in my presence. Curious about the next sentence. You shall not make for yourself a graven image or anything like this. And it says, which is in the heavens above.
In other words,
I'm just confused because,
sun, moon, stars.
Sort of making it seem like, okay.
Sun, moon, stars. It means don't make any depictions of heavenly beings that you might bow down to.
People won't make the picture either.
So we're going to get into that a little bit later. I'm telling you, this class is chock full of goodness. This is unbelievable, this class. Wait, hold on. Let's talk about the class for a second. No, I'm kidding. So the point is, the simple meaning of this and the way we're going to end off, I don't want to give too much away too soon, but the one way to understand this is don't make an image of heavenly beings nor of earthly creatures. Now, you can't take a picture. Can't make a sculpture. What's going on here? We'll get into it a little bit soon-ish.
So, two questions I've got on taking the silver that was used, melting it, and then elevating it to something.
Yeah.
And based on a previous class we just recently did, melting it, changing its form, it no longer belongs to who had it before.
Correct.
That was my question.
Oh, nice. Look at you guys.
Yeah.
Perfect. I'll let you answer each other.
And we didn't plan it.
That's amazing. So we got planets. I said, speaking of planets, I'm just, hey, sorry, I had to. It's right there. It was right there. Okay, so here's the short answer. To question number one, some things you can elevate, some things you can't. King Saul famously was told to destroy Amalek. The soldiers, the cattle, everything. And he let the animals. And the prophet Samuel came by the next day. He's like, what do I hear? What are all these animals? And he's like, it's like the Hulk Hogan thing. And he's like, he's like, oh, we're going to bring us an offering to God. Does God want your offerings or for you to listen to him? Prophet Shmuel HaNavi, the prophet Samuel says. In other words, even if a person says, I'm doing it for God, but what does God want? Right? God says, I don't want it. So here, your theory, you're right, but God says clearly he doesn't want it. So no matter what we could do with the gold, God says, I don't want that gold. Don't use the gold. So we don't use that gold. That's point number one. Point number two is we did say that when you change a thing's form, it changes status. But that's where the status is changeable. Again, in this case, it says it's straight up a biblical verse that says, that's the verse. You cannot, as MC Hammer once said, can't touch this. Yeah, sorry. They were. So, right, what I'm saying is, listen. We can't, well, it might have been, we don't know. That's a great point. This is what it says. The same God that said, take that, said, don't take this. Go figure, right? I'm sure it's probably discussed somewhere. Maybe it's because the money was originally Yosef's. He was the one that got all the money. How did Egypt become wealthy? Because they were the ones that stockpiled the food. And who ran that operation? It was Joseph. So maybe since it originated, it's his money, you know, money that he kind of brought in, wealth that he brought in. So maybe gets kicked back. I don't know. It's a good question. Okay. We'll leave that as an unanswered question. All right, that's our first of the night. So text number two, this comes from the Talmud. And please read text number two.
Rabbi Yochanan says in the name of Rabbi Shimon ben Yehotzadak, regarding all of the transgressions in the Torah, if a person is told, transgress this prohibition and you will not be killed, he may transgress that prohibition and not be killed because the preserving of his own life overrides all of the Torah's prohibitions. This is the halakha concerning all the prohibitions except for those of idol worship, forbidden sexual relations, and bloodshed. Concerning those prohibitions, one must allow himself to be killed rather than transgress.
This is one of the more famous passages in the Talmud when it comes to life and death law. The Talmud famously says, in general, when it comes to Torah and mitzvot, you violate a mitzvah to save your life. So if a person is, God forbid, starving, you eat whatever you eat. If a person needs to go to a hospital on Shabbat, you take them to the hospital on Shabbat. Pick up the phone, drive it, whatever it is. The mitzvah goes out the window. Whatever. The mitzvah is overridden by life and death. With the exception of three. And you see them right here. Idol worship, forbidden sexual relations, and bloodshed. Let's focus on the first one. It comes to idolatry. So we say that if a person is told, bow down to an idol or worship, we'll get into the exact definition of this soon. That's a major part of this class. Worship a foreign god or practice polytheism as opposed to monotheism. So a person is, halacha dictates, Jewish law dictates, that one should give up their life rather than violate this prohibition against idolatry. Idolatry is so fundamental, so core, that it's not like life will go on after. It's like there's no life, so therefore, yeah. We did it based on this ruling. That's why I mean, this is literally the source. I wanted to include another passage of the Talmud that says that when the second temple era began, the first temple was destroyed because of idolatry. When you read the scriptures, idol here, idol there, it was crazy. They couldn't get rid of it. So pervasive was this idolatry in the times of the first temple. There was a temple standing in Jerusalem, and there was a kingdom in the north, kingdom in the south, and they were steeped in idols, certainly in the north, even in the south a little bit. It was meshuggah. So the rabbis, when they reconvened for the second temple, so they prayed to God to remove, to eradicate the pleasure, the desire for idolatry, and it worked. So to a certain extent, that desire is eliminated. So it's very hard for you and I to relate, maybe at least for me to relate to somebody passionately desiring to serve an idol. Now we have other, you know, metaphorical idols that we serve, you know, money and honor and power, all of these things, right? So we all have the sports, right? American Idol, it's literally called that. So there are things that we supplant for that we get very excited about that aren't purely monotheistic or purely about only God, fine, but this desire to like bow down to a statue, I don't know when the last time you had that desire. It's not something, but the Talmud says there's a reason for it. It was taken away. In fact, the Talmud says that there was a rabbi teaching about one of the kings whose name was Menashe, who was the idolater, who was one of the idolatrous kings, and the rabbi says to his students, tomorrow we're going to learn about Menashe. He like kind of dismissed him in his introduction. That night, the king appeared to this rabbi in a dream and said, you're dismissing me. If you were there with me, you would be picking up the hem of your garment and running after me to worship idols. Don't look back at history at a different era and say, that guy was weak. Look at them, they were corrupt and immoral. Look, they were serving idols. Had you been there, you would have been at the head of the line also. It's different times, different eras. We can't always relate. But the point is that the Talmud says that if it comes down to a choice between life, you know, between worshiping idols or death, then a Jew is commanded to choose the latter as opposed to the former. And again, this has been done countless times in Jewish history, in Inquisition, so many times this happened where Jews chose Judaism over life itself. Now we get to a core question. And our topic tonight, this was all introduction about idolatry. Now we get into the main focus. There are three parts that remain. Number one, is Christianity idolatry? And if it is one permitted to go to a church? And if one is one allowed to view the artwork in a church? These are the three steps. So let's begin with number one. Is Christianity idolatry? Now, when we say this, when we ask this question, let's understand that there's two ways to understand the question itself. One question is about other faiths, and this is also true about Islam. Is Islam idolatry? Is Christianity idolatry? One way of asking the question is about the faith itself for the members of that faith. Another way to ask the question is that faith considered idolatry for us as Jews? And that's what we're going to focus on tonight. The question is not for members of the faith per se, but it's rather the way Jews look at other faiths. Is it considered to be an idolatrous faith? So famously, the Rambam, Maimonides, writes in letters and in his guide for the perplexed. So Maimonides famously is of the... We're going to have three opinions about this, by the way. Maimonides' opinion, the first opinion that we'll cite, is clear that Islam is not idolatry, but Christianity is. He says, Islam, and I know we're being recorded, and this is for posterity now on the podcast, Maimonides says that Muhammad might have been a madman, and he might have been whatever, but at the core, it's monotheistic. They don't have any form of otherness other than God. They believe in God. They have other prophets, but Judaism also has prophets. But as far as deification, deities, they have one. It's monotheistic. He says Christianity, on the other hand, He says when you have something called a trinity, then already it's more than one.
They
right?
bow to idols when they walk in the church. They bow to idols.
So this
but
I don't...
You see the idol as having power itself. You see the idol or the representation. I disagree with that.
So one second. So a few points. Number one, there are three opinions. Rambam is, Maimonides is only one, and you may feel more aligned with the other two. So hold that thought, because we may say something that feels like what you're thinking. That's number one. Number two is Maimonides is speaking from a very straightforward approach, and what he's saying is like this. Somebody says, let's talk about a human relationship. Someone says, let's get married. And we're going to be, what's the word? Monogamous? Monogamous. Monogamous. It's just you and I. Right? You're my only spouse. Except two others. But that's it. It's only you. But there's three. It's like, well, wait a second, just make up your mind here. Is it one or is it three? Like, what's it's one, but it's really three. And part of what makes this confusing is that within Catholicism, Christianity, etc., there's so many different that we think Judaism is fractured with denominations. Ho, 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 ho. I don't know what that was. But there's so many denominations in other faiths, and I'm not an expert. I'm working on Judaism. I'm working on them. It's a work in progress. But other faiths, I certainly am not an expert in. But what I do know, from the little that I know, is that these topics, what is the Trinity? How does it work? What is the relationship between the one and the two and the three? That is also a bit of a moving dialogue, or different strands, different branches have slightly different takes. Maimonides says, that's all what we know or what we don't know. I'll tell you what Maimonides writes clearly. Islam is monotheistic. Christianity is not monotheistic. Straight up. He says, once you introduce a notion of a trinity, no longer are we exclusive. It's like, me, it's I'm exclusive to you, plus a few others. That's already, once you have a trinity, then it's no longer exclusive. Now, something fascinating. Something absolutely fascinating. Oh, I feel like this is too much background information for the time that we have, but I do want to go through it. So we're just going to jump in. Dan, please read text 3a. This is Rambam, and again, I just told you what Maimonides, what Rambam says. You're going to see this now in two instances in his halakhic writings where he writes about the status of Christians, but here's the amazing thing. If you open up a standard edition of Maimonides, you will not find the word Christian or Christianity mentioned.
Is it politically
correct? Nope. It was edited. You have to look at original prints that were published in Muslim lands that anything published in Europe was censored by the church. There's a Frankel edition of Maimonides, and I'll show you. What I want to do with 3a and 3b and 4a and 4b is show you how it was modified over the years by the censors and what the original is, just to see what's going on. All right, 3a. Again, there's a little bit too much background here that I included, but let's go through it to the best of our ability with the time constraints that we have. Dan.
When wine has been poured as a libation to a false divinity, it is forbidden to benefit. But we do not know whether wine belonging to a Gentile is used for libation or not. It is called ordinary Gentile wine. It is forbidden to benefit from it, as it is forbidden to benefit from wine used as libation. This matter is a rabbinic decree.
So let me explain before we continue, because that next paragraph is the cool part where we see how it was edited. But let me just explain this for a second. Maimonides, and this is based on the Talmud and other earlier citations of Jewish law, basically like this. There are certain ways, standard practices of worshiping idols. Again, do we know from this today? Most of us don't. But back in the day, this is what was going on. The way they used to worship idols, some standard ways, bowing down, standard practice. And also another one, there are more than two, but two that I'll mention, bowing down to something as a form of worship, universal, and also pouring wine, a libation. Again, who pours wine for things? But that's what they did. So pouring wine in front of an idol or whatever god thing was a standard way of worship. So halacha. So Maimonides says like this: when someone pours wine in front of an idol, what about the rest of the wine in the bottle? It's not kosher. We had the text from Deuteronomy that talks about the gold that was used for idolatry. You can't use the gold. You've got to destroy the gold. You can't repurpose it. You can't repurpose the wine. Once it's been used, even part of it's been used, that whole bottle, that whole whatever, jug, the container of wine, it's out the window. Then Rambam continues and says there's a rabbinic decree. What if wine is used by an idolater, but you don't know if he had at some point poured it for his god? It's wine in his house. You don't know what he did on last Sunday. Did he pour it for the idol? Did he not pour it? Don't drink it. Don't drink it. Don't get any benefit from it. Avoid it. Why? Because we're concerned, maybe. Now we continue. Now we continue. Dan.
With regard to any Gentile who does not serve false deity, like the Ishmaelites, it's forbidden to drink his wine as a safeguard, but it is permitted to benefit from it. With regard to those who worship false deities, by contrast, it's forbidden to benefit from the ordinary wine.
Okay, so that's the end of this text. So again, Maimonides now makes a distinction between, I translate as Ishmaelites, because in the Hebrew it's Yishmaelim. Yishmaelim is Yishmael. Yishmael is Ishmael. He means Muslim Arabs. That's where he lived. Huh? Maybe Maimonides knew a few that didn't officially drink alcohol, but they might have had a few bottles at home, you know, for New Year's. I don't know. This is what he was the doctor. Doctors know things about people and populaces, right?
How can you drink it, but you're not benefiting?
Here we go. No, the opposite. The opposite. He says you don't drink it. He says don't drink from the Muslims.
Yeah.
Don't drink the wine. Even though, according to him, we know that he felt that they were that Islam is monotheistic, but he says you never know. Whatever, don't drink it, but you can have benefit from it. What do you mean you can have benefit from it? And if you get it as a present, you can sell it. Like you can get some benefit. You don't have to destroy it.
You can have a liquor store and sell wine.
You can have a liquor store, exactly. But don't, or you can sell their wine for that. Whatever. But don't. Better not to drink it. But when it comes to those who worship false deities, no drinking, no benefit. Stay far away. That's the standard edition. Turn the page, 3B. Dan, please continue.
With regard to any Gentile who does not serve false deities like the Ishmaelites, it is forbidden to drink his wine, but it is permitted to benefit from.
Identical to this section is now in the unedited version. So far it's identical, but look what he says next.
Christians, however, do worship.
In the original, thank you. In the original text of Rambam, in the Frankel edition, and this is an original text of Rambam. He writes, if you want to read the Hebrew, he says like this: Aval ha-notzrim, but the, I think in English it's Nazarenes, yeah. But the Christians, ov de avoda zarahein, they are idol worshippers. V'stam yenam aser bana, and therefore the wine is assumed to be. We stay away from the wine on every level. So here we see again one opinion, Maimonides' opinion, that he says, well, what is the status of Christianity? He says it's not monotheistic, it's polytheistic. It's considered to be in the category of idolatry. Now it doesn't mean that Christians are necessarily bowing down to idols. But it's not purely monotheistic, and according to Rambam, that puts it into the other category. It's either monotheism or it's not monotheism. And he says once you have this Trinity business, he puts it in the other category, and that affects the halacha when it comes to wine.
Rabbi,
yes.
What about the Christians that don't have any symbols, like Unitarians?
We're about to get to some other opinions that I think will address that. And Mark, your point as well, I think, will be addressed as we get into two other opinions, both cited in the Tosafists' opinions. We'll get there in a moment. I have another... Yeah, I think we can go through it. Let's do 4A and 4B. Same idea. Stanley, please read these. This is, again, 4A is the original... Sorry, 4A is the classic Rambam that people would study. If anybody buys a set of Rambam... typically, you're going to get 4A. If you get a Frankel edition, if you get the original edition, you're going to get 4B, which shares another angle on it, and specifically regarding our discussion about the status of Christianity according to Rambam.
Is that available today?
Yeah, you can get it. Yeah. Okay, 4A.
It is forbidden to purchase or sell any durable entity to an idolater within 3 days of one of their holidays.
By the way, let me explain what this is. The concern here is if you sell something, not a perishable, if you sell something, you know, something of whatever, to an idolater before 3 days of their holiday, they're going to use it for idol worship. Or if you buy it from them within 3 days of their holiday, maybe they did use it for their worship, for that idol. You see how... So 1 second. This is discussed in halakha. Hold on. We're going to get into this. The Tosfot asked this question, and therefore he has another opinion on the status of Christians. We're going to get there in a second. But here's what the Maimonides says, and it says in the Talmud as well. So within 3 days, before or after, don't do business. Don't do business buying, selling, because... But you see how I don't want to use the word paranoid, but how cautious, careful Jewish law is regarding anything that might have potentially been involved or would be involved in idolatry. We don't have anything to do with it. Such a big prohibition. It's the second of the Ten Commandments. We want to be very careful to stay away from any of this stuff. Okay, so continue, please.
When does the above apply in Israel? In other lands, however, it is forbidden to engage in such activities only on the day of the festival itself.
Continue, please.
Canaanites are idol worshippers, and Sunday is their festival. Accordingly, in Israel, it is forbidden to conduct transactions with them on Thursday and Friday each and every week. Needless to say, on Sunday itself, when transactions with them are forbidden everywhere.
Now, so because the main thing I want to focus on now is the opening of that second paragraph, which says the Canaanites are idol worshippers. Canaanites are idol worshippers with a holiday on Sunday. Canaanites have Sunday holiday? What Canaanites do we know? Take a look at the unedited version or the uncensored version, the Frankel edition, text 4b.
The Christians are idol worshippers. Sunday is their festival.
I mean, the rest is the same. That's all you need to know. The original, he wrote, Hanotzrim of the Avodah Zarahin, the same. Christians are idol worshippers, and Sunday is their holiday, etc., etc., etc. In the edited version, when it went through the church editors, went through the Christian editors in Europe, so they struck it out. They changed it from, and I don't know if the Jews changed it preemptively or if the church changed it, who knows. But it was changed from Christians to Canaanites, and everyone was happy for hundreds of years until, you know, we found the original versions, and that's what it says. So what we want to prove here from here is not what the final halacha is, but what Rambam's opinion is. What one leading halachist opinion is that Maimonides says clearly in many places, in letters, in other... By the way, the Rambam also wrote this to people in Muslim lands who were being forcibly converted. And he said, it's still monotheistic because if it would have been Christianity, it would be a problem. But if it's Islam, it's... Maimonides has a clear opinion. Islam is monotheistic. Christianity is polytheistic. That's one opinion. We have two more. Let's take a look. Such an interesting halacha. A lot of these laws, by the way, some of these laws, I can't say a lot, some of them, we don't 100% carry out today because various things on the ground have changed, which we'll discuss, and that may impact what we're talking about. Lolly, please read text 5A.
Joint ventures lead them to quarrel, and Gentiles object of idol worship. The Torah states, and make no mention of the name of the other gods, neither let it be heard out of your mouth, which includes causing a Gentile to take an oath in the name of an idol.
So the Talmud has a very interesting law. It says, don't go into business. And by the way, today, Jews specifically look for Gentile partners in business because it helps with various areas of Shabbos and other things. Again, this law is not necessarily practiced today, but here's what the Talmud says. We're learning this more for the concept. The Talmud says that it's better not to enter into a partnership with someone who's not Jewish. Why? Because if you get into a business dispute and you need to go to a court, maybe you'll go to a Jewish court, and the court will administer an oath, and the non-Jewish business partner will take an oath, but in the course of the oath will swear to his God, which is not a monotheistic God, and thus will be taking God's name or using God's name or swearing falsely or whatever that prohibition would be. Sorry, it's right here. Make no mention of the name of the other gods. Oh yeah, we had that in the beginning. Don't mention the names of other gods. And meanwhile, he's going to mention the name of the other god in his oath because you got into a fight with him in business because you took him as a partner. So therefore, to avoid the oath, don't get into business with him in the first place. You see how like many steps removed that is? Because we're worried about a dispute, and it's going to go to court, and he's going to take an oath, and he's going to cite the name of his god, and that's a problem. So therefore, don't be his business partner. Okay, fine. Tosfot has an interesting angle on this. Look at 5b. Lolly, please read one more on page 6. Look at text, yeah, please read text 5b. Rabbeinu Tam, who's one of the Tosafists, let me explain the Tosafists. So many of us know Rashi. Rashi lived in the 1000s, 1000s, what do you say? 1000? 11th century, so much easier. 11th century, 11th and 12th century. His grandsons, he had daughters, and they were scholars, and they had sons, and they wrote books and commentaries, and they're known as the Tosafists. Tosafists means like Tosef, like additions, they added more commentary on top of their grandfather's commentary, and they disagreed with their grandfather, especially Rabbeinu Tam. Some of you know that Chabadniks put on two pairs of tefillin, and others, some Hasidic groups do that as well. We put on Rashi tefillin and Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. There's actually two versions of the tefillin. The difference is the order, there's four sections of the Torah inside the tefillin, four different sections on the parchment. The question is what order, literally, it's everyone agrees which four are in there. The question is what's 1, 2, 3, and 4? Is it 1, 2, 3, 4 or 1, 3, 1, 3, 2, 4? Right? Different order, just a different order. And Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi had an opinion, and his grandson Rabbeinu Tam, who we're going to quote in a moment about something totally unrelated to tefillin, Rabbeinu Tam had another opinion. So therefore, some have the custom, Chabad included, to put on two pairs of tefillin, you daven in the Rashis, but then you wrap the tefillin, and you just say the Shema and the Rabbeinu Tam, and you take them off. So that's a Chabad custom. To get that in. There's a humorous story that's told that Rashi was holding his grandson as a young boy in his arms, wearing tefillin, Rashi was, and his grandson bumped them from his head. And Rashi said, ever since then, I knew that he would disagree with me about the tefillin. That's the joke that's told. I mean, I don't know if it's a joke, but that's the anecdote that I've heard. You know, I wasn't there. Okay, but let's... Huh?
Rashi's daughters wore tefillin too, though.
Rashi's daughters wore tefillin, correct. Correct. Oh, trust me, it's costly.
I know.
It's and Chabad typically has big. We do big tefillin. Like everyone is different. Chabad does a little bit of a larger size box, and that also just more leather. Just yeah, it's a thing. It's beautiful. It's for a mitzvah, but yeah, it's costly. That's the bottom line. Okay, so Lolly, please read this one. Here we have Rabbeinu Tam, the aforementioned Rabbeinu Tam, who starts opening up permission about taking oaths from someone who's not Jewish, which would then impact whether we go into business or don't go into business, but you'll soon see how this has a lot of implication for our conversation.
Rabbeinu Tam says it's permitted to take an oath from a Gentile to avoid taking a loss. In our times, while they swear by the objects of their worship, they nonetheless don't attribute divinity to them. Even though the mention of the divine name and have in mind other entities, it is not considered idolatry since their intention is for the creator of heaven and earth as well. And though they combine the divine name with other entities, Shituf, it is not forbidden to cause others to partner God together with other entities.
Let me explain. Let me decode. Thank you. Let me decode what Tosafot says. Oh, this is the attribution in 5b is incorrect. Well, it is correct. Whatever. On bottom of 5, it's right. And then when it says continued, it should be Tosafot Ibid continued. Okay, whatever. Here's what he's saying. He's saying, Rabbeinu Tam is saying that you're allowed to take an oath from the non-Jew. Why? Why? He says, because although they may mention other names, they mean God. They're just calling God by other names. You with me? There's a subtlety here. There's a subtlety here. Even when they mention other names, they mean one God. They mean to be monotheistic. It's just that they're saying, they're calling by other names. And then he says another point, and even if they do kind of mean something else like a trinity, he says the most that's happening here is not idolatry, but it's something called shittuf. It's not avodah zarah, it's shittuf, which is different. Let me explain what this is. Idolatry means worshiping another god. Shittuf means like shutfot, which means like a partnership. We'll just go partnership. Shittuf, partnership, means that you believe in God, but you believe that God partnered with some other forces as well. So it's like a tag team, but God's there, but there are others involved. Rabbeinu Tam says like this, his opinion. Idolatry, Avodah Zarah, means you don't believe in God, you believe in some other force entirely. He says Christians don't not believe in God. They do believe in God. And sometimes when they say this, they mean God. But even if not, at most what's happening is something called shittuf, which means that they're believing in God, and then they believe that God also is working through or manifesting in or working alongside whatever the nuance is with this thing and that thing. But the point is, it's like a conglomerate. He would say that the concept of Trinity, especially the way people understand it, is not that they don't believe in God, but they believe in God plus a few others. And that's not idolatry, that's shittuf. Now, for a Jew, shittuf is problematic. Because for a Jew, monotheism is strict, exclusive monotheism. But some say that for someone who's not Jewish, there's no prohibition against this partnership type of arrangement, which means that according to Rabbeinu Tam, now, this gets a little bit tricky. Every human being, according to the 7 Noahide laws, every human being, as a child of Noah, is prohibited to worship, to serve idols. So Maimonides is saying that Christianity is idol worship, therefore it's a problem. Rabbeinu Tam is saying it's not idolatry. It's shittuf, it's partnership. And as partnership, that is only something that Jews are told not to believe in, but not non-Jews. In other words, 7 Noahide laws does not prohibit the concept of shittuf, partnership. Does this make sense? Is this making any sense at all? Therefore, the concept of, let's say, Trinity is not considered to be in violation of the 7 Noahide laws for a Christian. For a Jew, Jews cannot believe in multiple partners, but for someone who's not Jewish, based on Noahide laws, that, according to Rabbeinu Tam, is not a problem. So therefore,
we know his opinion.
What?
That was his opinion.
Well, he was Rabbeinu Tam. He's not just an opinion. He's...
Does anybody else agree with him?
Well, Maimonides disagrees with him. Maimonides says it's straight up idolatry. He calls them multiple times. He says, "Oh, they have avodah zarah, they're idolaters," which means they're doing something wrong. That's Maimonides. Rabbeinu Tam says Max is partnership. They're not worshiping idols. They believe in God. They're just... God also has some partners. It's a partnership. For the Jew, that's a problem, but for the Christian, it's not a problem yet. According to Rabbeinu Tam.
With the Trinity, whatever, to
yes.
Me, it is certainly not identical, but it's similar. When we think of the Jewish spirit, the Jewish soul,
yeah.
We say there's a neshama.
Yeah.
We say there's also a nefesh, which is the blood soul. We don't believe we have multiple souls. We believe they're all part of the same thing, but we do believe we have different...
the question is, right,
different aspects.
How close are we getting to God with that multiplicity, though? That's the question. When it talks about a soul that comes from God, you should know that when you get into Kabbalah, it becomes a little bit tricky. Because Kabbalah speaks about God having 10 attributes. What's attributes? Sfirot. What are attributes? Is that suddenly multiplicity within God? What about strict monotheism? So you have to be careful when studying or teaching or learning or speaking about Kabbalah to be able to separate things. And Kabbalah will always clarify that at the core, God is one and only one. At the core, there's only oneness. And then you have... That's the nefesh calling. Joking. Right, at the core of God, there's only oneness. And then on a lower dimension, that's where you have this refraction into different energies and different sfirot and different attributes. But at the... Well, that's attributes of mercy, right? But that's always removed from the core. The challenge is, and again, I'm not an expert in Christianity or Catholicism or that those doctrines, and I know that that's been a discussion in those circles for a long time as far as exactly what they believe as well. But there is some sort of core fundamental belief in something in addition to God at the very core. That's the whole concept of Trinity. From what I, again, this is not an expert speaking, but this is, first of all, what's being discussed here, which is what I'm presenting, and, yeah.
There is a Trinity, for example, that we certainly would say is idolatry. And so, for example, with Hinduism, they believe there's three gods. They have, and they each have their own persona. They believe there's a Brahma-Atman, they believe there's Vishnu.
Careful with those pronouncements of names. Exodus 23.
The point is, though, that we would say is straight up
right.
Idolatry.
Right.
They're not saying it's just a different aspect. These are different entities. And that's, I mean, I hate to argue for that. But
No. Why not?
They're not saying there are three separate things you pray to.
But different. They do say, and they require people to say that they believe Jesus is divine.
Oh, yes.
I mean, so that's why...
Well, so there you go.
That is true. That makes of the Father,
So one second. So if you're... Hold on. But if you're saying that...
He's the Son of God.
But it's not the same thing. There's another thing that's also God-like. In other words, you're attributing divine qualities to another element. So you're saying it's one plus one, but it's all part of what...
Well, to me, it's like nefesh and neshama.
Yeah, but that's not God. So, but we don't say that with God. We don't go nefesh, ruach, and neshama with God.
Right.
With God is just God. With the soul, we go nefesh, ruach, we go five dimensions, but not with God's essence. But they're doing that with God at the top, so that's where it gets a little bit tricky. Maimonides says straight up idolatry. Rabbeinu Tam says it's one plus one plus one. It's not idolatry. We can't do that, but they can do that. It's not a problem.
That's, I guess I have to look at it and say, here's Hinduism's Trinity, so to speak, and it's straight up, it's three.
I get what you're saying.
Christianity, I think part also came about.
Listen, all right, what could
Christianity practiced today, and I've studied this pretty extensively. They put Jesus higher than God. The church in America, the Christian church in America, they're mega churches.
Yeah.
And if you, and I did a study of some mega churches. It was scary. And they really do believe that Jesus is the focus, that he's the modern God.
Right. Now, Rabbeinu Tam, I think, is saying that even when they say that, they pretty much mean God.
Yeah.
But it's still, but right, Maimonides says, I'm not buying it either. Right. Yeah.
So, first of all, in Hinduism, they have over 6 million deities.
Wow.
And before my Reformation, I'd been to Catholic Church. Okay, they pray the Virgin Mary.
Sure.
They don't talk to her; they pray to her.
That's right. They're intermediaries.
Oh, good. Fine. So that's all we need.
Mary's an
That's it. So that's all we need. Yeah. That's what Rabbeinu Tam is saying. Rambam would say that's idolatry. Rabbeinu Tam would say that's shittuf. It's not that they wouldn't pray to God, but they're also praying to her, right? So Maimani says idolatry. Rabbeinu Tam would say they also believe in God. So it's a partnership. It's a conglomerate, but that's not okay for us.
Seems the stuff that I've read about it, and I've not read extensively, but Christian belief is that you get to God through Jesus. So yes. You pray to Jesus to intercede on your behalf.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with praying to Virgin Mary, you pray to her to intercede on your behalf with God.
All the different saints, you pick your saint.
Yeah.
And by the way, Maimonides, when he traces idolatry, he says, you know how it began? It began by people believing in God, but thinking that God probably is not involved in the weather. So if we want to pray for things to grow, we have to pray to the sun god, and to the moon god, and to the rain god. Because God probably, the one big God, is probably not really that attentive to the crops in my field. Because God's probably way busier than that. And Mani says that's idolatry. Some say that's more like shittuf. Whatever it is, but we get the picture here. Now, let's introduce quickly, because we're going to go over time. I'm just letting you know straight up. But I want to get the third opinion in because it's good to have a well balanced, or just to know the three primary positions on this. All right, Doreen, please read text number 6. Oh, this addresses the question about doing business. Remember the Talmud says, or Maimonides says, not to do business within 3 days of their holiday because they're going to buy and sell merchandise that maybe will end up for idolatry. So Tosfot, in another tractate, asks the following.
So you went 6?
Yeah, you're good.
In our day and age, how do we conduct business with Gentiles on their holidays, including Sundays? It seems that the reason for the leniency is because we know that the Gentiles among us are not actual idol worshippers.
Listen to what Tosfot here, a different, not Rabbeinu Tam and that Tosfot, a different Tosfot, they had multiple.
I've always preferred Maimonides.
Well, so hold on. So here's what he says. He says, we know the Christians, they lived in, Tosfot lived in Provence, in France. In France. That was Christian Catholic, whatever. That wasn't,
they
that.
Also had a business.
That explains everything.
Provence. Well, I don't even know. Okay. But I'm not sure. So here's what he says. Who was there?
The Pope was there. The Pope was in Avignon.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
At that time? The 1200s? 1200s? Maybe? But look what he says. But look what he says cynically. It's almost cynical. He says, we know that Gentiles amongst are not actual idol worshippers. You know what that means? Christianity is idolatrous, but we know these guys. They're not worshipping anything. Do you understand what he's saying?
Yeah.
They're not actually worshiping. They may show up. They may, but they're not really believing. They don't believe in idols. They don't believe in it. Right? So they may call themselves Christians or Catholics or whatever, but they're not actually worshiping idols. So you can sell to them. It's fine. They're not doing anything with it. You really think they're going to use it for idol worship? They're not worshiping idols. Even if they call themselves belonging to that religion, they don't actually worship idols. So again, that's somewhat of a cynical take, which means that maybe each of them was speaking to their own experience, where they lived, when they lived, and who they knew. Or it reflects different areas of Jewish law. And you should know that even with these three opinions, which I'll summarize very briefly in just a moment, with these three opinions, you should know there's multiple opinions about exactly the meaning of these three opinions, but I'll tell you the simplest. That's just to summarize. Rambam Maimani says Christianity is idolatry. Rabbeinu Tam says in Tosfot and Sanhedrin, which was text 5a and 5b, Rabbeinu Tam says it's not idolatry, it's shittuf, partnership. It's not that they don't believe in God, they also believe in God and some other things. And Tosfot in Avodah Zarah in text 6 says, Christianity may be idolatry, but Christians are not idolaters. They don't worship idols because they're not worshiping. They're showing up. They don't want to get in trouble, but they're not actually. Again, it's a little bit more of a cynical take on it. Okay, so those are the three opinions.
I just wondered, what is the translation of the
Pilchot? Where?
Last one.
Oh, Palchu. Palchu means worship.
Okay.
serve, pray, beseech, daven to. They don't, even if they say it, they're not really meaning it. That's what Tosfot in Avodah Zarah says. Okay, fine. So these are the three opinions, and okay. So what rises from these three opinions is that one could say that there's a difference between the status of Christianity and Christians themselves. Christianity is certainly, according to the third opinion, text 6, Christianity may be idolatrous, but maybe Christians aren't idol worshippers, right? Or it could be that there's no idolatry at all, it's only partnership, it's not pure idolatry, it's only attributing other parties to God as well. Okay, so those are the three opinions. But bottom line is, after all is said and done, what is the status of a house of worship of Catholicism or Christianity? What is the status of that space? Statuses, according to most, at least two out of three opinions here, right? Even if the individuals aren't worshiping idols, but the place is a place of officially set as a place of Christian or Catholic worship, which according to two of the three opinions that we stated is idolatry, even according to the third, or the middle one actually, that it's shit of partnership, that might be fine for them, but it's not fine for us. So the question is, when it comes to a Jew visiting a church, so now what do we do? So take a look at text 7a. Bert, please read this one, 7a on page number 7.
Rabbi Akuna and Rabbi Yo's son were once walking together when they came across a fork in the road. One of them slid past a house of idolatry and the other past a brothel. Let's go past the house of idolatry, suggested one. The other responded, let's go past the brothel. And they followed the latter suggestion and passed by the brothel.
So, listen, they came to a fork. What a fork, right? Pick your poison. The house of idolatry, of idol worship, or the brothel? So one's like, idolatry. One says brothel. They went brothel. So Tosfot, the Tosafists were very... You study Talmud and you have a lot of stories and a lot of disputes. Tosfot, Rashi kind of tries to explain what's going on. But the Tosfists, they were really into halacha, the law. Like, what's the law? Let's break it down. So Tosfot, please continue, 7b. Tosfot pulls from this story a Jewish law.
One can infer from here the fact that the rabbis chose to walk in front of a brothel rather than pass the house of adultery, that the proper distance it is proper to distance oneself from the entrance to the house of worship, but out to idol worship as much as possible. This is based on the verse, do not approach the entrance to its house, proverb, which is interpreted earlier in the Talmud as a prohibition against the coming close to a place of Allah.
So Tosfot says very clearly that the rabbis chose to walk in front of the brothel instead of past the house of idolatry because we're supposed to avoid going to a house of idol worship as much as possible. And it's connected to a verse from Proverbs, from Mishlei, which says, do not approach the entrance to its house, as Tosfot quotes the Talmud in saying. And this, one more line, Bert, text 7c, this is the way it appears in the code of Jewish law. So that's what it says. Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's so weird because just tonight, like, as I was coming up Ponce, I was looking at the churches on the right. Like, I'm not just saying this because this is what we're talking about. And I normally don't get, like, creeped out when I look at, a cross outside of a church. But for some reason, tonight I did. I was like, I looked at it.
You were picking up the energy of the class.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So I know people, based on this law, that will cross the street. As opposed to walking in front of the sidewalk in front of a church, they'll cross the street. In deference to this prohibition it's not a prohibition. The way it's phrased in Shulchan Aruch is it's a mitzvah to lehisrachek, to distance oneself 4 cubits from a path leading to idolatry. Now, so this just says a path of idolatry, avodah kochavim. What's the status of a church? this could be a place where they bow down to statues. But what about a church, right? So it depends on what we had in the previous discussion. But according to most opinions over there, in the section before, a church would have the status of a place, at least, of foreign worship. And therefore, it would be proper to distance oneself from that place of foreign worship for cubits. Now, how would this apply, I asked in the discussion question, how would this apply to visiting the Vatican? Should we visit, or should perhaps we not visit the Vatican? At this point in the discussion, what would we say?
No.
It would seem like maybe no, it's not such a good idea. Okay.
Rabbi Lau went.
Who?
Rabbi Lau.
Yeah.
They moved all the statues.
So hold on 1 second. So now we get into another question. A building that's used as a church, right, would have a sanctuary, if that's what it's called, I guess, a place where the room in which they do the service, but would have other rooms, and the grounds, you imagine, are large grounds with yards and fields, whatever, yards and other
gardens
and other things. When we talk about not going to the house of foreign worship, what does that mean? To the sanctuary itself or to the whole grounds? Like, what does it mean? So let's now continue with other church spaces, text 8a. Mark, please read this from the Code of Jewish Law, 8a. 8a on page 8.
If a city is holding a fair as part of a pagan holiday celebration, and people are gathering there from all around to give honor to the idol, it is permitted to pass by that city, but forbidden to enter. However, if you are a citizen of that city or traveling as part of a caravan, it is permitted.
So let's pause for a second. The whole town is gathered to worship a foreign idol, a god, a deity, whatever. Or if you say that other religions are idol worship, then it's a other religious holiday that's happening in the city. It's taken over the city. Code of Jewish Law says, avoid the city. Don't go in the city. If you live there and you got to get home, so you're allowed to go home. If you're in a caravan, fine, but otherwise, don't go in. Why not? Number one, we're supposed to avoid foreign worship, but here you have a whole city. So if you live there, you're going home, you're not going to worship. If you're a caravan, if you're part of a group, why does that help? What's the concern maybe if you'll go as a single individual, as just you going into this group of idol worship in the city and you don't live there? What's the concern?
See the light.
Well, yeah. Right? Hey, we got a good candidate. Bop, bop, bada, bada, right? They'll pull you in with the hook and that's it. Hook, line, and sinker. Well, it could be Marasayim, but in this, which means it doesn't look right. But I think there's more of a
temptation.
Maybe they'll get you. Maybe they'll chop a Jew. They'll grab a Jew, right? But maybe they'll convince you or whatever. So if you live there, then that's what you're going there. You're not going to check it out and maybe get lured in by it. If you're part of a group, you're also a little bit more protected. Understand that this is going to have ramifications for taking an individual tour of the Vatican or taking a group tour of the Vatican. What I'm saying is, halacha is, these are not like ancient cities, like they would have these weird things and like don't go unless you're part of a caravan. Well, I'm not going to a city that has idolatrous worship throughout the whole city. And I don't, what's a caravan? What are pioneers now in the old West? Who goes in a caravan? What I'm saying is, the Vatican is a city that's pretty much built around one thing, or is a space that's built around one thing, and a group tour is a caravan. I hope you're understanding what I'm saying here. This is a practical area of Jewish law. But continue one more text, 8b, the Ramah, continues and adds on a very important point over here. Yeah, please.
Some say that the courtyard of a house of idol worship has the same status as such a city described in the Shulchan Aruch, and hence it is permitted to enter such courtyards, so long as the courtyard is not actively being used for idol worship at that time.
I need to explain. A city at the time of the celebration, don't go in. But what about when there's no celebration? You're certainly allowed to go in. So the Ramah says, some say that the courtyard, the yard, the gardens of a church, if we're calling a church, which we are, let's say at this point, if the gardens of a church are, when service is not happening, the garden is like the city when the worship is not happening, and therefore, just like you're allowed to go into the city when the festival is not happening, you're allowed to go into the gardens, not in church service times. And part of that is, I think, related to what we just said, because if no one's hanging around worshiping idols, then no one's going to lure you in. Continue. And it's not going to look like you're there for the service. Continue.
However, there are those who say that it is always forbidden to enter such a courtyard, since the path of the courtyard leads exclusively to the church.
Yeah.
The custom is, in accordance with the first opinion, to permit walking in such a courtyard, but it is praiseworthy to avoid such paths if there is an equally convenient one.
So he's speaking directly about if you're walking through a place that there's a courtyard and you want to cut through the path and the service is not happening, it's a Tuesday, you know, evening or whatever it is, can you walk through? And he says, some say yes, most say yes, some say no. If you want to be really strict and careful, then no, but otherwise you can do it. So the point is, bottom line is, most halachic authorities today follow what the Rama says according to the majority opinion, and they say that you can go to a church not during service hours, not to the sanctuary, but to the other spaces of the building or the yard. So when it comes, practically speaking, when it comes to polling stations, you're voting, and they set it up in the hallway, and it's not a Sunday morning or whenever they're worshiping. Are you allowed to vote in a church? Some say no, based on the other opinion in Ramah that says you should avoid it even in other times, because that's what it's... But some say yes, because you're not actually... It's not... No one's praying and worshiping. It's not at the time of that service, and you're not in that space of the service. You're in an outside room or hallway or other space. And therefore, it's not so terrible to go there.
But if you're in a group, it sounds like you can go there.
If you're a group, you're allowed to go to the city, one second, but not to participate in the thing. So in a group, you can't... Jewish law would still say not to go to a church service with a group.
Right. No, here's my question.
Yeah.
This past fall,
yeah.
We went to Italy, as you know. And we also...
This is hypothetical.
No, this... we went to Italy. And
right.
While in Rome, one place we went was the Vatican.
Right.
And by the way, you can't go inside the things you want to see with the Sistine Chapel.
Right, right.
During services.
Right.
They don't, I mean, that's a special right. thing. But, you know,
right.
So in other words, and it said, this is a repository of some of the most fantastic artwork. In other words,
good.
But in other words, the Sistine Chapel is a sanctuary.
But you can't go there.
Those in there, and there's thousands in there, are not there. There's no service going on.
Oh.
They're just looking at the artwork.
Okay, so, but it's still the space where worship does happen, right?
It does happen, not while we're there.
Yeah.
There's no... it's not happening while we're there.
I hear you.
And
the Code of Jewish Law says that it's those areas outside the actual space of worship when worship is not happening that's permitted. A space that's used for worship, even when worship is not happening, is probably a little bit more, again, theoretically, right? Theoretically, it's probably a little bit more iffy. Now, the last point is, so the bottom line is, funeral service in the actual sanctuary, better not to. If the polling station is in the actual room, also better not to, etc. If it's in an outside space, then we have...
It's in the school part of the church.
Yeah. Oh, school is not worship, but you're saying maybe because they teach about the doctrines there? It's a good question. I don't know.
I voted in a Catholic parochial school in Brooklyn, and the first thing I saw when I walked in was a picture of Kurt Polk.
Huh.
The second thing I noticed was that voting machines were painted gray, and all the Democratic levers, the paint was worn off.
Huh.
Republican levers.
Pristine. Untouched. That's great. Okay, so again, so the short thing is that the church probably, according to most, would have the halachic status of a space that we should not go into, that we should stay away from, based on the verse that the Talmud says in text 7a and 7b and 7c.
Even if you're on a Greek group tour, you're saying.
Yeah, because the only allowance is for those outside spaces. The space itself, it says distance 4 cubits from the space of the worship itself, when it is, when it's not. The question is, when it's not happening, where can you go? Can you go to those outer spaces? So that's, but it's still the outer space when it's not happening. That's a discussion. And there again, we have some that still say no, but most are allowing it under certain circumstances when it's innocent. But again, some say when you're going to the Vatican and you're part of a group tour and you paid money for it, you're not there to be inspired. You're not there to see the light. You're there to get your money's worth, right? And to, you're there for a service, the other type of service. You're there for, it's not working in English, right? You're there for a purpose, but not a religious experience. So some say that visiting at least certain areas of the Vatican would not be such a problem. Now, what about viewing the artwork itself? We have to really speed it up now, because I know we officially are till 9, but that's never been a thing the last few weeks. So 9:15 is more like it, but even that we're getting close to. I think I want to just paraphrase 9a and 9b. Yeah, I'm going to give you the upshot. You know, we had in the Lolly asked this before, in the Ten Commandments, it seems like we're not supposed to be making any images of heavenly beings and earthly beings. So what about paintings? What about sculptures? You can't draw a sun, you can't draw a skyline, you can't draw a human being, a plant. Famously, there were some that would, rabbis back in the day, they would not want their photograph taken, they would not want their portrait being painted, because they felt like, there is a dispute based on the Talmud, not in the Talmud, but based on how you understand the Talmud. There's a dispute about what that prohibition entails. Most commentaries, and it's all there in the text. I just want to paraphrase it just so it'll be easier. It'll be quicker. Most say that the prohibition in the Ten Commandments about making these images is only if it's an idolatrous image. That an image that's going to be worshipped of the sun or of something on earth. But if it's just a nice art depiction, it's not a problem. And that's most people. Some really pious people, it says in the Talmud 9b, there was a Rabbi Menachem, the son of Rabbi Simai, who refused to even look at the image on coins. A coin that had a coin always has some person's face on it, right? Right?
Everyone wants to play poker with it, right?
Well, he's not looking. Doesn't matter. So he wouldn't even look at the coin. That's how religious he was, or how whatever careful he was. He wouldn't even look at coins because he felt that, and the coins aren't being used for idolatry. But he would not look at these images whatsoever. So, okay. But that's kind of the exception. The rule is, most people are saying, most halachic opinions and poskim say, that it's not a problem to look at art or to create art in general. It's only when it's connected with idol worship and or other foreign service, and depending on our discussion in section 1 about, or section 2 about Christianity, the status of Christianity, that would fall into play. So when it comes to religious art, art of a religious nature, one would say maybe it's preferable not to focus our attention on that. Doesn't mean you can't glance at it, but it means that to focus attention on it. If it's religious and idolatrous in nature, then maybe not so much. There is, but if it's other art, even if it's housed in the Vatican, if it's other beautiful art, you're allowed to look at art wherever it is. You're not in the sanctuary. You're not looking at, you know, idolatrous art. You're just looking at art. Maybe it shouldn't be a problem. The last text that we have, which is text. Oh, by the way, text 11 is germane. Jerry, please read text 11, because this kind of connects to how we started.
It is forbidden to listen to the instruments of idol worship or to view the beauty of idols that have been worshipped, since one derives enjoyment from the sight.
Remember we said that you can't enjoy anything from idol worship or anything connected with idol worship? So to look at the art that's created for the worship of idols or about the worship of idols or other foreign worship, which, depending on how you define other religions, would fall into that category. So therefore, if you think, wow, it's beautiful, you just benefited from something associated with foreign worship, and that is not ideal. But if it's not religious art or it's not foreign worship art and etc., and it's in a kosher place, then it should be fine. The last text 12, we're not going to read this inside, but just so you know, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who was one of the leading poskim of the last century, lived in the Lower East Side of New York. So he ruled, and it's right there in text 12, he took a hard line on this, and he said that even if it's not religiously depicted, even if the art doesn't depict any type of religious images, but it's housed in or near a house of other foreign worship, he says it's there to lure you in, or it's there in conjunction with that experience, and therefore he says it's better to stay away. According to him, he wasn't, I don't think he was writing this about the Vatican itself, but according to text 12 and Rav Moshe, he's not the only posek, he's not the only opinion, but he took a very hard line on this, and I just want to end with this. He said he would likely say, even if you're allowed to walk there, but to even look at that art, and even if it's not religious Christian art or whatever it is, it's just art, it's beautiful art and whatever, he would say that it's better to avoid that than to do that. But again, he's not the only opinion, and some opinions say that as long as it's not overtly idolatrous and it's not in the actual space itself, then you're part of a group, etc., then there's more of an allowance. Bottom line for us is we should recognize that we have a unique belief system. People talk about Judeo-Christian values and they kind of lump them together. And it's a nice talking point, it sounds cool, and I think many Jews might like that because it's almost like, well, validates us. Like, oh, we're part of the group, part of the majority now. Like, oh, we're Judeo, and we're first Judeo-Christian. Ah, you see? We got before the hyphen. But we don't, it's not necessarily like just the same thing. It's not necessarily the same thing. Judaism has a very strict, very, very pure monotheistic belief. Christianity, maybe not so much. Islam has its own, you know, measure of what that is. The point is, let's celebrate what we have and celebrate the exclusivity that we have in this relationship. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for the Jewish Da Vinci Code. And thank you for joining me for this series of headlines. And I look forward to possibly doing more, rolling out more of these topics. And I'd love to continue at a later point. Thank you very much for joining me.